They found coke at the White House.
They found coke at the White House. You are so excited to talk about
this. I'm so excited. Is this not exciting for anyone else? When in our life has coke ever been found at the White House?
I was hanging out with Justin for the 4th of July, and I feel like in the same way that Santa Claus can restore Christmas to a small child, Uncle Sam came and drizzled cocaine in the White House and just... energized Justin's entire day.
Did you see that they evacuated the White House?
They did. They thought it was. Well, that's the only reason we know. If somebody walked in and found coke that was not a low-level person who thought it might have been anthrax, they would have just put it in their pocket and then asked around later. Like that. There's the only reason why we are aware is because somebody looked at it, thought it might have been something dangerous, and then they eventually tested it and they found out it was cocaine.
I feel like the Obamas had a lot of like cool musician friends. I don't think this is the first time coke has been in the White House. I just think Hunter's really dumb and he left it
absolutely
out.
Not. Well, that's and here
or like just some legislative aide that was working at 4 o'clock in the morning. Like could be Hunter, but my guess is that non-fuck-ups also do a lot of coke in the White House. It just is kept behind closed doors.
Hunter jokes are obviously paramount here. Many people, including myself, not only did I put in our group chat the "I think you should leave hot dog man" meme of Hunter being like, "We're all looking for the person who did this," but also multiple other people sent me that. So there is a lot of jokes there, although it's actually kind of serious because part of his plea deal to get out of the stuff that he just made the deal for are that he stays off drugs. So
is Hunter hanging out in the White House regularly? I'm kind of guessing that they would keep him away from there.
Well, and Joe Biden wasn't there. So why would Hunter be in the White House without his dad? So as
party
much
at dad's
as,
house, yeah, right? Dad's out of town. Let's have some booze. Let's dick around in the Oval Office.
Well, number one, bringing in some interns. Like Biden's not there. Well, no one thinks that Joe's like, break out the gear, Jack. Like we're ripping rails. I don't think that's
God save the queen, man.
Yeah. Somebody left it there, which is another thing for those who are not aware, have not been around people who do coke. Very rarely is coke just left somewhere.
Yeah.
Like if imagine with your phone, whenever like your phone and you leave your phone somewhere and you're like, and you always pat your pocket, you don't even realize that you're patting your pocket to realize that you have your phone. That's what people who do coke are like with coke. Like they always assume it is somewhere. It takes a real person of means to accidentally leave coke somewhere.
That's a good point. Okay, I haven't thought about that. That is a really good point. Like,
very expensive.
You're drinking a beer, you're three quarters through, and you're like, it's kind of tepid. I'm just going to leave this beer here. I don't need to finish this, right? Every once in a while, somebody does that. Not me. I always finish my beer, but I think healthy social drinkers do that. But like cocaine doesn't strike me as the kind of thing where you're like, I've done enough coke. I'm just going to leave it here in case anybody else wants it.
Yeah. Does not happen.
People who do coke will like lick the table to get the dust.
Yes. Yeah.
They don't just leave it unless you're rich. Like that's.
Which is why it is a particularly funny situation that A, somebody would leave coke anywhere. If somebody left coke at an Applebee's, it is a man bites dog to me. The fact that they would leave coke at the White House is one of the most extraordinary stories that I have seen in the garbage dump of politics.
I'm also thinking, I don't do cocaine, but if I did cocaine, I don't think I would bring it into like high security federal areas unless I really thought I was going to be shielded, right? Like if I could really swing my dick around and be like, get the fuck out of here. You can't prosecute me. Maybe I would do that. But I've never been that level in anything in my life, right? I've always been a flunky. I would not have brought any drugs into Congress when I worked in Congress. That would have been a bad idea, right? So whoever brought it in probably doesn't think they're going to get in trouble.
Well, so that's the thing, right? We know that there's cameras everywhere. Do you think there will be a follow-up to this story and we'll have any chance of finding out who it is?
Oh, you want to know what? I think it's going to be a triple header press conference. We're going to find out who planted the bombs in front of the RNC and the DNC on January 6th. We're going to find out who leaked the Roe versus Wade verdict. And we're going to find out who the real snorter was in the White House. one big press conference where we're going to get the full story on all three of those.
Okay, I changed my opinion. This is what I think happened. I think July 4th in the evening, Joe Biden called Hunter and went, hey, man, you got to take the fall for me again. I left cocaine. And he's like, Dad, everybody thinks I'm a fuck up. And he's like, well, I know you're not a fuck up, but seriously, I'm doing really well right now. I'm president. I could get elected 2-3 more times. I really needed to take the fall on this, buddy. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I'm mid-80s. I'm tired. Like, thank you for my supply.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were always wondering why Joe Biden was so much better in the first half hour of those debates. And then he flagged off. Maybe that's why. He was just doing some backstage tutors.
You know, a fun historical fact, a lot of the people we love and know in history were on a lot of drugs. Like Churchill and Kennedy were on a lot of meth.
Yeah.
Like we would call it prescripted amphetamines, but amphetamines. Like Kennedy was on a lot. And Churchill would, you can read accounts of people hanging out with Churchill and they're like, he just talks and talks. He talks so fast. He thinks so much and he constantly talks. And I'm like, funny that, you know, who tends to do that? People on meth. And he had like, his pills, he had whites, reds, blues, and Lord Morans. Lord Moran being the name of his doctor that he named one of his pills after. But he was just like getting, like just guzzling amphetamines over the course of the war and after that as prime minister.
Did we ever get confirmation on the rumors of Trump's Adderall use?
I don't know if we got confirmation because presidential physicals are always kind of a farce.
His doctor said he was the most physically fit president in all of human history. And
he was
strangely Trumpian, as if Trump wrote it himself and the doctor signed off on it. But that can't happen.
Yeah. A diet of Big Macs. That is what all doctors recommend.
Yeah. No, normally, at least your doctor is just a guy that you golf with that, you know, is going to play the game, but at least be respectful about it and like list your cholesterol levels or something. But
you know what though? But okay, if you're eating entirely Big Macs, but you're doing 60 milligrams of Adderall a day to where those Big Macs are once every 3 days, that might be sustainable as a diet.
Yeah. I'm just surprised he still has a heart. Although Dick Cheney's still alive. So many would argue
he doesn't, Jen.
Yeah. Well, he's a teetotaler, though.
Yeah, he is. Dick Cheney, fun fact, Dick Cheney now has a heart, but for about a decade, Dick Cheney had no pulse. He had a heart pump that kept a constant circulation going through his veins. So, like, if you were to feel Dick Cheney's aorta during this period, there was no lub-dub. It was just whoosh, like a permanent thing. And then he got a heart transplant, so he's got a heart again.
He got a heart transplant? Like a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that could have gone to an actual person.
There was a story that Adam McKay, who did the Dick Cheney movie, he had done a bunch of research, obviously, to write the script. And then after the movie, finds himself with some of the symptoms that come along with a heart attack. And he recognized it very, very early because he had done all this research on heart attacks for the Dick Cheney movie. So he calls his doctor. Doctor calls, you know, an ambulance. He goes to the hospital and they're like, wow, you actually caught this. This was an event that would have gotten a lot worse, but you got it early enough. We were able to do the procedure and, or prep you for the procedure. And so the doctor who's going to come and perform it comes in and he's talking to him and McKay is just kind of like in a daze because this is all happening very, very quickly. And he babbles to the doctor. He's like, yeah, I just done all this research on Dick Cheney. And, the doctor goes, oh, really? Why? He's like, well, I'm working on a thing. The doctor goes, great American. And Chris McKay, shut up. Just let the man do. He didn't want to go into what his movie was about. He's just like, just please go ahead and fix my heart. Whatever, and then maybe we'll talk
whatever
later.
My heart surgeon's politics are my politics for as long as I'm in the hospital.
I'm just surprised that they would give, like, how old was he when this happened?
Probably in his 70s. I mean, I'm just stepping out on a limb here. It's almost as if well-connected people get some sort of choice in the queue.
Yeah, because I didn't think that they gave hearts to people that were that old. But I don't know how any of that works. I'm just surprised.
Texas. I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And from Mexico City,
I'm Jen Briney.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to talk a little Supreme Court roundup, as well as American pride, as we roll through our Independence Day week here in America. Let's go ahead and start off with this little tidbit. We had a listener send in, which of these 4th of July songs, 4th of July bangers that are actually really critical of America, do you like the best? And they listed Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, American Woman by the Guess Who were Lenny Kravitz, Independence Day by Martina McBride, or American Girl by Tom Petty. Which of these
critiques of America? I'm going to.
Well, these are on like every Spotify 4th of July playlist because they have America in the title. But yet they are, when you listen to the lyrics, they're very critical.
So in terms of critical, a couple of years ago, I was doing karaoke in Tulsa and I heard Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden for the first time.
Okay.
That's my favorite critique song. That one's badass. It's about like the imperialists coming in and setting fire to our village. It's like, I'd say that's my favorite critique.
What's your favorite America centric line in that one?
The refrain, run to the hills, run for your life. I think something like that.
That has America in it.
No, it doesn't mention. You could make the argument that
I don't know. I mean, I know you're going off the board here, but yeah. Cause I listed four and right. I asked you,
can I see this again?
Yeah. I mean, you have a sheet. I give you a prep sheet.
Yes. American Girl. No, American Woman. I like American Woman.
American Woman.
Yeah, Born in the USA gets kind of rote.
Yeah. Jen?
I don't really like any of these songs, to be honest. I think I'm just overplayed, I guess. If I had to pick one of the four.
Yeah.
American Girl, probably Tom Petty.
I stayed in the dorm that the college student allegedly dropped out or jumped out of and died. At the University of Florida in Gainesville that made Tom Petty write that song.
Well, that's fun. I don't know if this is an American song, but my favorite, like I like We Didn't Start the Fire. And I'm trying to think of the lyrics in my head and most of them are American centric.
Well, it's about American. Well, it's about world history, but certainly from the American lens of a Long Islander in Billy Joel.
I mean, even the mentions of things that happened overseas, it's usually like places we bombed. And so I consider it American.
Yeah. I listened to a great song that I commend to everybody. I believe it's called Down by the Lake by Dean Summerwind or something like that. And it's one of the funniest country songs I've ever heard. It's just like, I'm parked down by the lake, 80 miles from Santa Fe. That's right. I'm parked down by the lake. And it's just rehashing that one line for 4 minutes and 30 seconds with all of the like pathos of a country song. And it's so asinine that I love the parody of it.
Well, let's talk about the Supreme Court. I will give Heaton the first pick here. We have affirmative action, the right to not make a gay website for possibly non-existent gays, and student debt relief.
I, for one, think gay people exist. Andrew Heaton firmly thinks that homosexuality is a real thing, unlike my esteemed peer Justin Robert Young.
No. This is not the fact that there's not the existence of gays. There certainly are.
Stuart likes pussy.
Whether or not the specific gay in this case existed is a question. Yeah,
let's tackle that one then.
Yeah, let's start there. Explain how Stuart is not real.
The Supreme Court ruled in favor of a Christian website designer in Colorado who refused to create a wedding website for same-sex couples based on her religious beliefs. The court majority, led by Justice Neil Gorsuch, determined that Colorado's anti-discrimination law violated the designer's First Amendment right to free speech. They argue that the government cannot force individuals to speak in ways that conflict with their conscience on significant matters. The decision was opposed by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who believed that it undermines LGBTQ rights and marked them as second-class citizens. The ruling has sparked debates about the balance between religious freedom and anti-discrimination protections. Now, that was the ruling, but the case that brought it revolved around a same-sex couple coming to this woman. It's not a secret because this was brought up during the lower court's rulings on this, is that we don't know if the second half of the couple exists. No one's been able to conclusively find them.
No, they did.
The one name that is on there for sure is a web designer in San Francisco who's straight. So of the two men that were listed, the only one that is tracked downable is not gay, or at least says that he's not gay. Now we don't know. We can't look into the man's heart and know where indeed he he has lusted, but in terms of getting married to somebody, that seems to be something that is hard to track down and prove.
Well, there was a lot of suspect stuff. So he's married to a woman, has a kid. And as you said, he's a web designer himself. So even he was like, why would I hire this woman who's never done a wedding website to do my gay wedding when I'm not getting gay married? Like, there were just so many ways that this guy was like, what are you even talking about? Because he didn't know that his name, email, and phone were all in the Supreme Court case until he was contacted after the ruling, which is wild because this started in 2016 and no one called the dude. Just crazy. Which means that there might not have been standing the entire time.
Maybe not. I mean, I've only read a synopsis of this case. I haven't read any of the lower rulings, and I haven't read the dissent. But I will note that the dissent does not at any point question the standing based on my read of this.
So at the Supreme, I actually know something about this. At the Supreme Court level, that's true. But in the lower courts, there was a question about standing because in the beginning they said like, well, there's been no request from a gay couple to have a wedding website created by you. You've never even created a wedding website. So there's no injury here. You have no standing. And then this request came in after the fact. And then they started saying, well, there has been this request. So if you look at the older cases, when they were looking at dissent, they were using this if you're looking at injury, they were using this request over and over again, to the point that when it got to the Supreme Court, that was no longer a question. They never even brought up the idea that Stuart and Mike didn't exist because they didn't check. But the whole thing was like, there was no request. And so this was the request that gave this case standing. So that's the concern.
The one thing I would say about this particular thing is if the ruling went the other way, I don't think anybody would give a shit.
Yeah.
But it's a weird one.
I don't know.
It is weird. It's worth bringing up. But I don't think that if this affirmed the discrimination policy that you cannot be denied on the basis of your sexual orientation for services, I don't think people would be running around saying, well, there wasn't a real gay guy.
Well, I think the reason that it matters is people are questioning whether or not the group and this woman that brought the case were doing it to get this result. They made up a scenario.
I'm assuming that's what happened.
But she was also filing a preliminary injunction against the state of Colorado. Like that was the main thrust, was Colorado and Masterpiece Cakes had enforced similar requirements on interacting with gay weddings. And she was preemptively filing an injunction in the event that happened. So, as an armchair attorney, I am not familiar with standing within the court system. That is not something that I have any level of expertise in. But the actual Supreme Court didn't seem to have any concerns about that. From a consumer layman perspective, in politics and jurisprudence, I don't like the approach of, rather than engaging in logic, how do I dismiss this? How do I make it go away by dismissing it as opposed to engaging with it? And I think a lot of the stories that I'm reading about this case focus on that. I've read very few stories that actually get into the jurisprudence of it and the rationale of it. And then I think you could make a case that it would have standing because it's an act of controversy. To have standing, I believe you have to have an active controversy or like actionable case or something like that. I don't know that you could argue that it's not an actionable case, but I think you can make a good argument that it's an active controversy.
Well, one of the things she wanted to do is put on her website that she doesn't serve homosexual couples. And so that is the challenge to the Colorado state law, where like basically she was saying, I want to discriminate and make that clear. And so that was a part of the case too.
We need to correct this. She does not discriminate against homosexual couples. She doesn't want to be involved in gay weddings. She was clear that she was happy to work with gay people. It's just gay weddings specifically she didn't want to engage in. So there was no identity-based discrimination. It was activity-based discrimination.
I don't know. It seems like a distinction without a difference to me. Because it's discrimination.
You don't think so? I think it's very relevant. Like,
give us a very erotic example.
So I'm fascinated by this. I think that this is the most interesting case that came out in the SCOTUS docket recently, and it's kind of a bookend to the Masterpiece Cakes one that came out in 2015. Masterpiece Cakes. There was a baker in Colorado who was a very Christian guy that did not think that gay marriage was a valid sacrament and it was sinful and he didn't want to be involved in it. A gay couple asked him to make their cake, and he refused to do so. I will note, he did say, I will make you a birthday cake or some other cake. It's just your wedding that I object to. And I'm also happy to point you towards other bakers that would be amenable to it. So he got brought to court by Colorado. They said they ended up ruling against him and said, you have to make cakes for any wedding. And so he ended up closing the wedding part of his business, and he had to go to remedial training. And eventually the Supreme Court overruled Colorado on establishment grounds. So they basically said, in my reading, you can't compel somebody to participate in somebody else's sacrament. That if we're talking about creative endeavors where I am producing something creative, that the state does not have the ability to go, you have to agree with gay weddings. That was surpassing the constitutional prerogative of Colorado and infringing on somebody's free establishment rights. The interesting part of this case is that it's dealing with public accommodation. And so the court ruling is, again, in my read, that they're distinguishing between creative activity on First Amendment grounds and public accommodation. So if you're making a widget, if you're engaging in pure commerce conveyor belt type activity, where the customer comes up and the customer really has nothing to do with a product, you cannot discriminate in that regard. So, for example, a diner, you would not be able to say, I don't want black people in my diner, or I don't want gay people in my diner, or anything like that. That would not be grounds for First Amendment. You certainly couldn't do anything involving like an ambulance or something like that. Where the identity is just kind of at the receiving end of a product, there's no discrimination. However, if you're engaging in a creative activity, what the court said was, you can't compel somebody to give speech that they don't agree with. The example that Gorsuch lists, which made sense to me because I give speeches for a living in part, is that, for example, I, Andrew Heaton, who get hired to give funny speeches at think tanks and things, right now, if a think tank that I don't like calls me and says, we want to pay you to give a funny speech about something you disagree with, I have the ability to turn that down and say, I don't want to do that. According to the logic of the dissent, because religion is a protected class, and in the Civil Rights Act that this all hinges on, if a religion were to ask me to go give a speech about why like Islam is the best religion or why Christianity is better than atheism or whatever, I would have no grounds to turn them down because I would be discriminating against their religion. And what the court said was, no, if it's a creative activity and it's a speech activity, you do not have the ability to compel somebody to engage in speech they disagree with. So in terms of the creative cakes 303 or whatever the name of the company is for LLC, if a gay person said, I want you to make a Shopify website for me, and she said no, she would not be able to legally do so because that would be a public accommodation. But if a gay couple says, we want you to make a web page for our wedding, which is going to be more individualized and creative, and she has to make it for both people and it's her engaged in the activity, that is beyond the confines of public accommodation and gets into freedom of speech.
I guess, but I look at it as, I mean, I can see everything you say makes sense to me. I think this is why this went all the way to the Supreme Court. But on the other side of it, it's not really her speech, right? She's taking a wedding website, which gives you logistics. If there's writing about the couple, usually it's the couple that does it. Like, you're really plug and playing information into a decorative thing online. So it's not really her speech. Your analogy of like you going to a think tank and saying, you know, Islam is the best, you know, religion, or saying something you don't believe, that's literal speech. But this is kind of a plug and play. Same with the cakes. Like, you're putting frosting on a cake. What really differentiates that from a birthday or wedding cake? And my concern, just like big picture, is where's the line? Where is the line between something that is artistic and something that is just something you provide to anyone? Because you could make the argument that a cake is just a cake. And so the fact that that is now allowed, you're allowed to say like, well, because of my religion, I don't approve of your legal marriage. I mean, what is marriage? Is it just religious or is it a legal binding? So it's like, because I don't approve of you being legally bound as a couple and getting more rights as a couple, I can no longer sell you this dessert. So it's like, I don't know how we figure out where the line is going to be from here. And then when I look at the precedent, we had the Hobby Lobby case, which essentially said that a business owner can take their religious thoughts and determine whether or not their employees get birth control or not. And now with this case, we're saying that the religion of a business owner can be inflicted upon the customer. So I look at this big picture as very religious people on the Supreme Court elevating religion in our society and really making it very unclear where the line is. Because even in these examples that we're using that were ruled on by the Supreme Court, I don't think they're all that clear cut. I don't think this is a First Amendment thing for a website, and especially not a cake. So I do see this as discriminatory. I think it's discrimination that was legalized. I really do.
I think the question of where the line is was the central argument of the 1963 civil rights legislation, for which a lot of this stuff has continued to be a reverberation. And part of what I, you know, in Raise the Dead, the history podcast that I did about the 1964 race and Barry Goldwater, and I think the unfair shaming of Barry Goldwater as a racist was based on his question of this line will be hard to hold. It will be hard to enforce, and it will be something that will continually not only incentivize a snitch culture where we are constantly looking to blow the whistle on each other because we are 1 millimeter to the left or to the right of where we assume it is. And this is even, let's say this was a total a fabrication by the woman who did this, for which I think that there is argument to say that there is at least some production value to it. That is a retaliation of what religious liberty advocates look at with the Masterpiece case cake thing, where they thought they were the target of somebody creating a gigantic problem where it didn't really exist, so they could set legal precedent and damage, you know, somebody's business. So this is always been a pernicious problem since we've moved the line legally into this world of discrimination. And it's not to say that it's not a righteous cause to do it, but to think that it's easy, I think, would be foolhardy.
I think this ultimately, this issue hinges on just basically how you approach pluralism. And a significant part of pluralism is, are people allowed to be assholes? So I'm very pro-gay. I've had 4 of my last 6 birthday parties at a gay bar.
You own a rainbow suit.
I own a rainbow suit. Any gay people listening, if we're ever in the same area, you get married, I'm happy to officiate your wedding. I could not be more pro-gay. Mm-hmm. That said, though, like for somebody.
Prove it.
That I will marry a gay man to prove my commitment. But like, I think the question with like the cake maker is that guy allowed to have a reprobate opinion? I would regard it as a reprobate opinion, but he's allowed to have it. For me, where I would compel somebody to engage in something that I believe is correct and true and good is if it is going to inflict bodily harm through their omission, or it's going to have a direct monetary or livelihood contribution. So this is not how the courts approached it in either ruling. But for me, I would kind of apply rational basis versus strict scrutiny. For people unfamiliar with these terms, rational basis is kind of the lowest hurdle that court cases do when the government is being sued on something. Rational basis just means, could there be a reason for the government to do it? So if you sued the government because your town is giving subsidies to anybody named Mitch, that would not pass rational basis. Someone would go, that's just not, there's no argument for the government there. But we're going to make all the houses have pink because our town did it. You could maybe make a rational basis argument. Strict scrutiny is you really, really, really have to have a good reason for the government to be abrogating somebody's rights. And I would apply strict scrutiny to these kind of things. So again, if somebody is, they think that gay marriage is incorrect and they refuse to drive their ambulance to a gay wedding that had an accident, That passes strict scrutiny for me. Like your religious rights at that point are secondary to the life and harm that's going on. But like a cake, that's not, it's not necessary at any point of this. It's completely ephemeral. It's completely aesthetic. And so what we're really doing as a society is saying, no, you're wrong, and we're going to force you to acknowledge the sacrament. And I think that's counter to pluralism.
Jen, you have the next pick. Would you like the affirmative action case or the student debt relief case?
Let's do affirmative action, because student debt relief is a not a thing.
Well, let's do that then. The Supreme Court ended the practice of affirmative action in college admissions, ruling that race cannot be considered as a factor. The decision, which is seen as an achievement of a longstanding conservative legal goal, overturned previous cases dating back nearly a half a century. Specifically, it impacted Harvard and the University of North Carolina, which were at the center of the case. The court found that race-conscious admission plans violate the Constitution and laws applicable to federally funded colleges. As a result, all such institutions, particularly elite ones, need to modify their admissions practices. The ruling was strongly opposed by President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. and the court's three justices of color, who each authored separate and powerful statements about race in America and the potential consequences of the decision. The votes were 6-3 in the North Carolina case and 6-2 in the Harvard case. And I will add here to my copy, it was strongly opposed by three of the justices of color, because Clarence Thomas was definitely on the majority opinion.
I read the whole thing, which took for fucking ever, because every justice wanted to put in their senior thesis on their thoughts on affirmative action.
Yeah.
Clarence Thomas by far sucked the oxygen out of the room. Whether you like him or hate him, he was the MVP in terms of just getting focus and attention. And I mean,
this one's been boiling up he's had a lot of
thoughts on this for a very long time.
Yeah. Jen, your thoughts?
I'd actually like to kick to Andrew first, because you're clearly the most knowledgeable about what the case was. So can you share your thoughts first?
Yeah. Let's start by saying what federal law previously was. There have been two decisions in the courts that had previously governed whether higher education could discriminate using race. The main case is Bakke v. California or something to that effect, which is from the 50s. Not going into that case, but just the ruling, what the courts decided was you can't make race the central reason that somebody gets in or out of a university. You're not allowed to use that as the defining characteristic of their admission, and you can't have racial quotas. So at no point during my lifetime has any higher education legally had racial quotas. What they did say was you can use race as a plus. So in effect, a tiebreaker. If you have five slots available and you have 10 candidates and they're all equally qualified, at that point, in the interest of facilitating diversity at a university, you can at that point go, well, we're going to try to bring in more Black people, or we're going to bring in Hispanic people, and so on and so forth. The other case that further modified this was Grutter. And Grutter added to it that this needs to be a temporary measure, that universities should not just have a permanent affirmative action program, but rather that they are tackling a specific problem and have a clear idea of when they're going to reassess or stop it. So you can't just permanently have an affirmative action program. Those were the two things that were governing it. I'll also note that that's federal. States further restricted that. So like California, for example, it's been against the law to do any type of discrimination in higher ed for a long time.
Since the mid 90s.
Yeah. 1996.
Yeah. So like this in like Oklahoma, like if you look at the map of states that did this, it's really weird because it's like Oklahoma, California, like states that you would not think would have anything in common. What the case came to with the Supreme Court was Harvard and UNC both were disproportionately turning down Asian students. And it looks by my lights like Harvard basically had a racial quota in mind and was coming up with ways to keep the Asian population at whatever they wanted it, which is about 12%. And so the majority opinion said basically the way to end racial discrimination in government is to not racially discriminate in government, like a very clear forward, just colorblind. We ought to be colorblind. Society's not, but the government should be. The court should be. They made several interesting and compelling arguments. One of them that I thought was, I never really thought about before, is the very odd way that diversity is handled in higher ed. So like at Harvard, there's no category for Middle Eastern. So if you're going to Harvard and you're from Iran or you're from Iraq, like you're not factored in at all.
You're not a minority.
You're not a minority. I was talking to one of my friends about this because I did the Comedy Sellers podcast, and he's from, I think Kuwait. And so he either puts white or Black, depending on what he thinks will benefit him, because he can make the argument that he's African. And it's also like
you would have thought they would have found it by now, Harvard.
It's, but it the categories were too, like Asian is just 60%
Don't they have a Bin Laden school? Or is that MIT? One of them has a Bin Laden school. I'm not joking.
The Asian category encompasses East Asia, South Asia, but 60% of the world's population is in that one category. Hispanic includes everybody that speaks Spanish, which are actually different ethnic groups. And then Roberts brought up that according to this idea of how we stack up diversity, having 15 students from Mexico would be equally diverse according to that rubric as having 10 students from 10 different countries in Latin America. It's a very like blunt, heavy way to do it. There were lots of arguments to be made. The argument that I thought was compelling was statutory rather than constitutional. Most of the justices, Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, came down on the 14th Amendment, the equal rights amendment, and said his logic was, look, the government can't discriminate based on color. And if the end of the process were discriminating on color, that's still discrimination on color. Therefore, it violates the 14th Amendment. Gorsuch goes a step further and invokes the 1963 Civil Rights Act, which really spells that out and says you cannot deprive somebody of a spot because of their skin color. And he goes, look, if there's a limited amount of spots available and the tiebreaker is race, then we are discriminating against you based on color. And then Clarence Thomas wrote a massive exegesis on why he hates affirmative action. He's also super snarky. He name checks Sotomayor, like snarky. Like he goes like, apparently Justice Sotomayor doesn't think that zero sum math is a thing.
Yeah.
And calls out.
That's that dude.
Justice Jackson, and says like she has a toxic worldview that is based on individuals being components of a race rather than being individuals. So he goes to the mat. Sotomayor makes the argument that basically diversity is important enough that it passes strict scrutiny, and that in the same way that we eventually realized that separate but equal is insufficient and we have to go a step further than that, she makes the case that colorblind is insufficient and we have to go a step further than that in order to meet the 14th Amendment. Jackson says similar things, but I think takes on an almost historical redress position of there are students that are disadvantaged. There are students that come from advantages, and we need to kind of balance the playing field through affirmative action. And that's the court case was ruled in favor of the majority. So by law now, you cannot use race as a determinant at any point in the process in higher education. Although I should note, the Clarence Thomas and Justice Roberts go out of their way to point out that you can absolutely use disadvantage as a determinant. If you want to use like the income level or the socioeconomic level of the family, if you want to use geography like inner city schools or Appalachia, if you want to use basically anything except race that might end up being a correlation with it, you can. They just don't want it to be race as the heuristic you're using. Thomas also points out that like, you might have somebody that experiences horrible racism and they overcome it and they're able to do it. And he's like, that's great. That could be factored into the essay. But the thing is that we're giving them credit for them as an individual triumphing over something. We're not giving them credit based on skin color. And so broadly speaking, that's the ruling.
Jen.
Yeah. So, thank you for that explanation. This is my week off and I just knew Andrew would be on top of this. So thank you very much.
So did I. Makes two of us.
Yeah. Thank you for doing our homework for us. So definitely coming from a place of being a white lady, but I kind of see where the majority is coming from here, especially where this case originated from, Harvard discriminating against Asian people, because if you're allowed to take race into account, it can also be used to discriminate against people. And so that was interesting to me. And I don't like discrimination in bakeries and I don't like it in higher education either. But the first thing that came to my mind was legacy admissions, because if you want to talk about why white people are staying ahead and especially rich people are staying ahead in places like Harvard, Harvard's in the class of 2025, their acceptance rate was 3.43%. So very few people get into Harvard, but the acceptance rate for legacies, 33%.
Yeah.
And so if you want to talk about unfairness in college admissions, if we're going to do this, which we already have, and get rid of affirmative action, I think we also have to do something about the socioeconomic unfairness in these colleges as well, because that not only holds, you know, black people out of these colleges, but it holds poor white people, poor Asian people, like anyone that doesn't have a history of Harvard level money. And so that's what I'd really like to see. But I mean, basically legacies are bullshit. And when they stopped doing them at Amherst, legacies fell from 11% to 6%. And then the, they got to the highest ever percentage of kids that were first generation in college, 19%. So, I mean, that would make a big difference for people just money wise. And then, but then when they got rid of affirmative action in Michigan, black enrollment in their highest universities fell from 8% to 4%. In California, within 2 years of affirmative action ending in 1996, enrollment fell by half of enrollment for black people fell by half at UCLA and UC Berkeley. And today only 2% of Cal students are black. So I mean,
that is not suggestive of at least the full picture that I've seen about the UC system specifically. Now that is more than obviously UCLA and Berkeley. So I don't know about those specific racist institutions, but in general with the UC system, black admission has gone up, not by a lot, but by about 5%. White admission has fallen. And the biggest beneficiary has been Hispanic admission.
Well, and that's another point that I want to make. We're really only talking about the most elite universities. So it's a really good point. Yes. About the UC system. Yes, it's harder to get into Berkeley or UCLA, which are some of the top schools in the UC system. But if you want to go to like, you know, UC Santa Cruz or somewhere else where it's like easier to get in, then This isn't really an issue. And in fact, most colleges in the United States take everyone that wants to get in. We're only talking about a small group of universities here. Yeah, we're talking about like
0.2% of the population. Yeah. And further, I don't know California schools particularly well, but it's brought up in the Supreme Court case that they're more diverse than Harvard and UNC. Despite having a prohibition on affirmative action, that might mean that black people have there's less black people there than there is in UNC. But overall, if the goal is diversity, that has been achieved in California without having affirmative action. And insofar as the legacy goes, Jen, as this group's resident elitist elbow patch Frazier clone, I 100% agree with you. I think Harvard is full of elitist bullshit, and I'm very glad that you brought that up. Two points to bring up. Harvard is not a meritocratic institution, and it's bullshit to claim that. 43% of the people that are enrolled in Harvard come in through the athletic program, the dean's list, which is to say people that give money to the university, legacies, and I can't remember what the other one is. But they're not there because they got there through academics. They're there because they got there some other way. Either their dad was a member or their parent is in faculty. Those are the four different ways. It's not meritocratic. And with the black people at Harvard, too, there was a study that came out. It was published in The Economist a couple of years ago, where the guy went through the data and 71% of the black people that go to Harvard are from wealthy families. So that is to say what Harvard likes to do,
my word,
based on the data, is find a kid whose parents are doctors that went to a prep school in Manhattan who's black and go, we did it, everybody. We're not racist. We brought another wealthy individual to our elitist institution to continue being elitist with. So I think Harvard's full of shit. And what I would do that I think Jen is onto is I would amend the 1963 Civil Rights Act or come up with an addendum. The 1963 Civil Rights Act that Gorsuch invokes on a statutory basis says that if you are a university that accepts federal funds, you cannot discriminate based on any of the protected classes therein. So that's why, like, I assume Oral Roberts University can turn down atheists if they want to, because they're not taking any federal funding. I think I could be wrong about that. But basically, if you're taking any federal funding, you're on the hook for federal law. So what I would say is, you cannot you have to prioritize. You can't have legacies if you want to take federal funding, and that includes Harvard. And Harvard could say we want to rely on our $28 billion fucking dollar endowment and keep doing things the way we've done it. Is it 58?
58. Yeah.
They could do that. I don't think they will. I think they'll take the money. And then as far as the affirmative action goes, like the people that are really outraged about the decision, I think have a very good point, and that there are lots of people in society that are disadvantaged. But my thought is go directly to the disadvantage. Skin color is a proxy for disadvantage. It's correlated with it, but it's not the direct thing. And what I mean by that is I am not worried about Clarence Thomas's kids going to a good university. I'm not worried about them getting discriminated against. I'm not worried about The Rock's kids or Barack Obama's kids. I'm worried about poor kids. And poverty is absolutely a legacy of Jim Crow, and it's correlated with it. But I also feel bad for like poor white people that grew up in Appalachia. My thought is go for the disadvantage. And the way to do that, in my opinion, would be to prioritize people that are coming from first generation college families. If make that the tiebreaker, if it's all things being equal, give it to the person whose family didn't go to college. And you're going to find that that's going to disproportionately benefit Black people, but that's a correlation and not just us picking skin colors and trying to allocate races or resources based on race. I think that that would more directly deal with what we're trying to fix.
Any kind of race-based programs are get to phrenology real quick.
Yeah.
Like whenever you start to talk about things based on skin color, the details get gross. They are idealistic in the summary, and in the details, you get either into bizarre stuff that they don't want to change, like what you mentioned with Harvard's. There is no Middle East when you are listing these kinds of things, or you get into really, really, in my opinion, gross racial characterizations of humans, and that is something that I think. Beyond the goal is largely with affirmative action that a subjugated class for which has suffered disproportionately based on laws made by another race should benefit, that there should be some sort of reparations-esque element that gives back to a community that was put upon. That certainly is something that in the abstract feels good to say. What I found interesting about not only this case, but also all the conversation around it, is that this was not a black-white issue.
No.
This was about Asians.
Yeah.
The forgotten minority that is oftentimes not a minority, or the model minority, or any different version. It was their community that was upset that their children, they felt, were being discriminated against, that brought this whole thing to a head. And I think that largely, they have been entirely erased from this conversation, which got back to one of America's favorite pastimes, discussing our original sin of slavery. And everything kind of comes back to that, no matter what.
Well, and that's why I'm glad that the justices in the majority really made a point to say that if race is something that's really affected your life, you can still say that and have it count in the essays. And what I have seen in the last week or so since this ruling came down is that schools are talking about weighing the tests less. So like SATs, I was one of those people that was able to get SAT prep courses. I took it twice. My score went up. Like, I am definitely one of those privileged people. A lot of people can't do that. So weighing those less and weighing the essays more could help even the playing field for people that did feel like they were held back because of the color of their skin. They can tell that story and have it count. But there's also people where the color of their skin really didn't affect their lives that much. Like, so I feel like I'm hoping that the colleges that actually want diversity will take some of these steps, and that people who feel like race was a big part of their lives can still have that be heard in their admissions process, but it won't be discriminating against Asian people. Like, that is where this court's this case started. I'm really glad that we're emphasizing that, because I think that sucks for them. Like, I grew up in Irvine, California, and everyone who's ever lived there will tell you that Asians have moved in. We have so many Asian people there, and their culture is they studied harder than I did. They worked harder than I did. They didn't play as hard as I did. Yeah, I swear to God, like they just worked harder, and I'm not surprised that they are trying to get into Harvard in large numbers. And so for them to be discriminated against does seem pretty shitty, because they merit-wise probably you're earning it in a way that I know I certainly wasn't. So, I hope it turns out okay.
Can I add one more thing, as I want to slam dunk on academia for a minute? I was okay with the prior Bakke ruling, where they used race as a tiebreaker. That it didn't really offend me, even though it was short of colorblind. My problem with academia, and this remains as well, is that I don't think academia truly wants diversity. I think it wants racial diversity and tokenism. But I don't see much evidence that universities are going out of their way to try and get diverse thoughts or diverse opinions. I think that they're doing quite the opposite. And I'm looking at that going, so you want to have everybody basically espousing the doctrine that you're putting out, but you want them to be colorful. That I don't think that's real diversity. I think that's just tokenism. And I would love for this to be an opportunity for universities to embrace diversity in all of its forms, including thought and opinion, and to tackle disadvantage directly.
I am going to hold my breath for the United States Congress to amend the Civil Rights Act and take away legacy admissions. A block of overrepresented Harvard alums, many of whom have Harvard educated children. I am going to hold my breath until they lower their grandchildren's chances to go to Harvard by a significant margin. I'm sure it'll happen. In fact, I think it's going to happen the same day we find out who planted the bombs outside of the RNC and DNC on January 6th, who brought cocaine into the White House, and the other one that I said was never going to be found out. That's all going to happen on the same day. We are all going to be thrilled.
Well, there are now three cases that have been filed against legacy admission. So we'll see what happens with that. But when you just look at bigger picture, I do think that this next generation, I mean, we're about to talk about student loan debt here. I do think the next generation is going to be a little bit more careful than we were, because I don't know about your upbringing, but like college was not a choice for me. It was like high school, then college.
It was a presumption. It was assumed.
It was a requirement. The question was, where do I go and how much will it cost? But it was not a choice. I think this next generation, with all of these avenues for education available to them, and like with the new reemergence of importance of trade, you know, trade schools, which, by the way, you still have to take out student loans and like get into those schools too. But I think the next generation is going to be more careful about going to college to get the education they need for the goals that they have, as opposed to it just being the next step. And so I don't think that this is going to be as important to the next generation as it was to us, because there won't be as much of a flood of students just trying to get into these schools because their parents said this is the next step and you're not really free until you're 22.
I would highly encourage my future bastard spawn to take a gap year and think about their options.
Can we please do the topic that we're actually talking about? The Supreme Court in a 6-3 decision invalidated President Joe Biden's student loan debt relief plan, ruling that that plan was an unlawful exercise of presidential power as it hadn't been explicitly approved by Congress. That plan, which could have relieved up to $20,000 in debt for eligible borrowers and impacted approximately 43 million Americans, was argued to be lawful under the 2003 HEROES Act. However, Chief Justice John Roberts asserted that that act's language was too vague. Biden expressed disappointment and vowed to seek other ways to relieve student loan debt, possibly invoking the 1965 Higher Education Act. The ruling puts pressure on the Biden administration to find an alternative means to forgive student debt that would stand up to legal scrutiny this time. So, with that being said, and I think we did half of our segment here before we did the intro, what was the biggest thing that stuck out to you, Heaton, in this decision?
I'm frankly surprised this wasn't unanimous. I'm not surprised on affirmative action or on Creative 303, the gay website one. That one, I think there were very good arguments to be made on both sides. This one, I think, is so clearly executive overreach, that this should have been a slam dunk from the get-go. I mean, here's some of the people that thought it was executive overreach. Joe Biden. That's the first one. I mean, like during the debates, Joe Biden was like, oh, the president can't legally do that. And Pelosi's like, yeah, that we couldn't do that. You have to do that through Congress. And then he got elected. And I think very cynically, he went, I'm going to do this. And if the courts don't stop me, great. And if they do stop me, I still get credit for it. And it was political signaling.
The plowed through an eight ball and he's like, fuck it.
Yeah, fuck it. We'll do it. The 2003 HEROES Act. I don't remember the exact wording of it, but it's basically like Congress can. The president has the option to suspend payments on loans for veterans that are actively over in Iraq at this time. So if you're in Iraq, you can wait till you get home to pay student loans. You still have to, but you can wait. And he had the ability, the president could delay the schedule of your student loans if you're a veteran. And Biden took that after saying he couldn't do it as, well, I can just cancel all student loans based on whatever I want, which the wording in the court case from Amy Coney Barrett was, this is like if you gave your babysitter a credit card and said, make sure the kids have fun tonight, and she purchases a car and is like, it's a real fun car. Like, it's, this is so clearly exceeding that. So I'll admit, I've not read the dissent. Maybe I'm going to completely eat my words and it's absolutely rock solid, but I'm surprised that just on a statutory basis, that there was really much disagreement on this at all. Because we're not, again, I always point this out whenever we're talking about law, with jurisprudence, it's not the job of judges to make what laws ought to be. It's not their job to go, Congress failed to do the right thing and I'm going to create this law. It's their job to clarify what the law is. And we can talk about whether Congress ought to do what Biden wanted to do, but in terms of the actual power admitted to him by Congress or the Constitution, I think it's pretty clear he doesn't have it.
Jen?
So my favorite thing about this is that my friend, a lawyer, Brianna Joy Gray, called this in fall of 2022. She did a whole monologue on Rising where she said Biden trying to do this using the HEROES Act is essentially bullshit. She's more eloquent than that. But she was just saying that using the HEROES Act was essentially doing this via a COVID emergency after President Biden had already said that COVID was over. So she was like, this is something that you do if you don't actually want to cancel student debt. If you want to cancel student debt, then she just lays it out. But she said the Higher Education Act is the way to do it because it allows modification for student loans and like lays out the whole plan. Now he's talking about the Higher Education Act, but even the idea, so like putting the court case aside, I'm trying to think of the students that are drowning in debt because, you know, we have, you know, I have a couple examples here. We have someone who took out a $16,000 loan and 25 years later has a $98,000 outstanding debt because she got a disability and couldn't get the debt discharged. And so it just keeps racking up. There's a lawyer who graduated in 2012 with $180,000 in debt. Balance is now $206,000 after paying back two of those loans entirely. The problem is the interest. And so even if you were to forgive all the loans that have happened in the past, unless predatory interest is illegal, we have not solved the problem. You've just taken a lucky group of people that have the debt up until now and forgiven some or all of it, whatever the plan's going to be. But the problem still remains. And so when I look at this, even if he does cancel the $10,000 that he's promising for people, which would be great. I mean, having $10,000 back in your bank account is always good. The root of the problem still will be there. And so as for this Supreme Court case, I'm with Andrew. I have no problem with whatsoever because this was easily foreseen. And I am cynical enough, and so is my friend Brianna, to think that Biden did this on purpose. Joe Biden is the senator of Delaware. He was the senator of the bankers and everybody knew it. And they like their predatory interest. So I think this was a ploy to get the youth vote to vote for him and then him not actually having to do anything to piss off the banks. That is my cynical view on it. We'll see if he actually uses the Higher Education Act to do anything. He's saying he will, but who knows? But the bigger problem is something that Congress has to address, and it has to be interest rate related.
I would push back on the idea that he cynically did it. I do think that he did not want to do it, but I think it was him being pushed into doing it by the more left flank of his administration. I will ascribe incompetence before I ascribe maliciousness, because also if he wanted to do this as a reason for the youth vote to vote for him, he would have done it now. He would have done it now, so the Supreme Court did not have time to hear it before the 2024 election, and that would be up in the air by the time that people went out and voted.
Well, this is a campaign promise that he made, and so then when he does it via the HEROES Act, knowing that it probably won't work, because I might buy that it was incompetence, except Elizabeth Warren was saying it should be the Higher Education Act. AOC was screaming it should be the Higher Education Act.
Sure.
Brianna was saying this in 2022 on Rising. Like, this was not a secret.
Yeah. I'm not saying that there weren't other people that were saying that. And certainly the more progressives were, and they are on the record as doing so. And I will ascribe incompetence before I say that it was maliciousness. A, just because it's incompetent timing. Like, there's no, just keep disappointing the progressives. If you are Joe Biden and you want to play to the center, do this in the midst of a campaign season when you need the progressive vote and you need the youth vote, and then let it hang in the air and say, hey, look, even if it doesn't pass muster, then of course you need me in the White House so I can do the Higher Education Act. Now he's going to have to either promise the higher education thing next term or try to do it now and deal with the messy fact of whether or not it works or it doesn't work. And you are out of bullets if it doesn't. So I am not necessarily here for the idea that, yeah, at least the political juice is not worth that particular squeeze from my perspective, as far as a conspiracy theory. But what we do agree 100% on is the predatory system for which is a cabal between higher education and banks to sign up kids who barely know are days into being able to sign these kinds of contracts that have a disproportionate element of their lives that are pushing back their ability to buy houses, that are pushing back their ability to get married or to have or feel financially secure, to have kids, to get cars, to have mobility, to have actually the utility that we used to say going to college was a must for.
Yeah.
Why did you want to go to college? Because you had a higher earning potential, because you were able to buy a house sooner, you were able to get a better job sooner, because you were able to have more of a mobility and go to different places and maybe relocate because your skill set would be unique enough that that would be a differentiator between you and the rest of the market. That is no longer the case. These degrees are overinflated. And while I do agree with you, Jen, the interest is onerous, the problem to me is deeper than that. The problem is the escalating cost of college, the decreasing viability of the degrees that kids are getting. And if they were assessed in the same way that banks assess you as a homeowner, except for the subprime stuff, but assess you at those rates where we were actually expecting these things to be paid back and not to be tied up in government schemes like this, then you would not get the kind of loan that you are almost immediately approved for in our modern world. This is a genuine cabal between higher education and the banks. And as I have said since I was in college, the only difference between a scummy, grifty carnival that is only there to separate rubes from their money and colleges is colleges realized they could make more money if they never left town and played football against each other.
I don't disagree. However, I will throw this out. Professors aren't the ones benefiting from this.
Hell no!
I did a bunch of research on this a couple of years ago. For anybody interested, I did like a 3-episode deep dive on why college is expensive on the political orphanage. And one of the things that I was surprised by was professors are not making more money than they were 30 years ago. The money is going into administration and it's going into programs. And I agree with you both. I think I would, if I were a senator or a congressman, not a judge, but in the legislature, I would be amenable to forgiving student loans as part of a broader deal that restructures the format and structure of higher education. And what I would probably do is, if you want to take federal funding, you have to have income sharing agreements as opposed to loans. I think that would solve everything moving forward for everybody.
What do you mean by
and
that?
And then the other thing, what'd you say, Jen?
What do you mean by that? Like, what's an income sharing
agreement? So Purdue does this or did this. I think they might have now closed the program, sadly. But right now, you take out a loan and you cannot ever discharge it through bankruptcy. It has compounding interest, as you pointed out. And you got to pay it back regardless of how much income you're making. So if you get out of school and your degree actually doesn't yield very much money, you still owe the bank or the federal government, depending on who you got the loan from, that money. The way an income sharing agreement works is rather than you having a sum of money that you owe, regardless of whether you make money or not, that compounds with interest over time and you can't discharge by debt, which all of which I think leads to just putting people in permanent penury and being able to get a house and being able to get credit cards and things. The way an income sharing agreement works is, you basically are signing a deal with the university where you say for 10 years following graduation, you get to garnish 2% of whatever I earn. And at the end of that 10 years, we're done. And so if I'm not earning any money, you don't get any of the money. If I'm earning a lot of money, congratulations, you get 2% of it. And either way, at the end of that 10-year period, we're done. So there's nobody that would ever have any lingering debt that would come out of this. I also think that if the point of universities is to get a high paying job, then you would see universities restructure their programs to reflect that.
Yeah.
The main thing though, is that just, you wouldn't be stuck with anything. And, I think that that's a more fair and equitable way to do that. And I think universities have largely become a credential mill, and their number one job right now is pumping out credentials that operate as positional goods so that you can be better than somebody else in the economy. And we need to rethink that.
I agree. And what I would do to solve the problem right now is I would just say for everyone who already has student loans, if you've paid those back, if you've paid your principal, I'd waive the rest. Because some of these numbers that I saw were just obscene. $16,000 loan is now owing $98,000. Like, that's ridiculous. So I feel like if you took out a certain amount of money, the bank should be able to get that back. In most of these cases, they've gotten it back many times over. And so to solve the problem at this moment, I would modify it to where if you've paid it back, you're done. And then we start over with I love that idea, Andrew. So we start over from there, but we do have to do something about people that are already under this debt. Yeah. We can't just leave them hanging.
100%. Yes. I would say declare yourself legally dead and get a fake ID. That would be my modern problems require modern solutions, Jen. And I would say declare yourself legally dead and get a fake ID.
And make sure you have a funeral for yourself so you can hear all the nice things people have to say about you.
Yeah. And take that meme picture of you in front of your own grave, given the deuces. that would be ideal. Patreon.com/wherenotwrong is where you need to go if you would like a bonus episode of this show. And also to get us over 900, this might be the week, friends. We are only 13 patrons away from 900, at which point our big milestone awaits. But you could be the person who gets us over 900 at patreon.com/wherenotwrong. And you're going to get a bonus episode, as you will do each and every week.
Do I get to rant about France?
You do.
Great.
This week we're going to be talking about the riots in France.
All the fucking moderate, calm stuff I've been saying in this episode goes right out the goddamn window.
Mm-hmm.
Pronounced window.
Mm-hmm. We're flipping cars. France,
so this is going to be an interesting one.
That's it. Get your yellow vests out, because we're talking about riots in France on the Patreon. But you on the main show, you guys get to talk about America. Recent polling data from Gallup and Pew Research Center indicates that a shifting landscape in American identity is afoot. An increasing number of Americans report declining extreme national pride, with Gallup showing this sentiment at a near historic low ahead of the forthcoming elections. Interesting, party affiliation appears to be a significant determinant of these feelings of pride, with 60% of Republicans still claiming extreme national pride compared to the peak of 86% two decades ago. Among Democrats, this sentiment has been dwindling, with many associating patriotic symbolism with divisive rhetoric. However, some Democratic figures are attempting to reclaim these symbols, reframing them through the lens of liberal policies and American exceptionalism. Moreover, the state of morality in the United States is perceived as poor by 50% of the population, according to Gallup, a record high driven by an increased focus on systemic racism and ongoing debates over abortion rights. The rise of the so-called war on woke has led to an uptick in legislation targeting LGBTQ rights and a perceived lack of consideration from others who have been identified as a top moral issue. And finally, Pew Research Center data reveals a significant shift in family values, with a record high 25% of 40-year-olds in the United States having never been married, an increase of 6% in 1980. This trend points to young people delaying marriage and having fewer children, leading to potential challenges for political campaigns centered on traditional family values. And so I will ask, are you proud to be an American on this Independence Day week? If so, why? If not, why not? Jen Briney, you're on the record.
Despite all our problems, I'm very proud to be an American. I think we are such a cool country. I love how diverse we are. I love that I grew up in a place where I was regularly exposed to, you know, gringos like myself, Mexican people, Jewish people, Asian people, Black people. Like, I know all the people. I know people from all over the world. One of my sister's best friends was Iranian. Like, I think it's really cool how easy it is to be exposed to so many cultures and just stay in our country. I love how big we are. I love that there's no passport needed to go to 50 different states. I love that New York and Louisiana have fucking nothing in common, and yet we're all Americans. I love our system of government. This is why I do Congressional Dish. I think the way it was set up was brilliant. I love that we can fire the entire House of Representatives every 2 years. We haven't done it, but that is what gives me hope. Like, when people ask, why did I do the show? I see that one little thing in our Constitution, that ability to fire our lawmakers and make a huge change using votes and not violence. I think that is amazing. And that is the avenue that I have so much hope in for, like, what we can do in the future. I love that we have been through a lot of shit and we have never canceled an election. Never. Civil War, World War II, 9/11. We've always had our elections. It's always been a peaceful transfer of power, despite what Donald Trump tried to do. I love this country, and that's why I do what I do. I want to fight for it. Like, I'm disappointed in some of the choices that we've made. I think some of the choices we've made is because we've been deceived by the, you know, the people that have power in this country. And so that is another reason why I do the shows that I do. I think this could be a part of the solution to be less deceived and to have interesting, nuanced conversations. But I'm very proud to be an American. And if I wasn't, I would not be doing this job and I would have left by now. So yeah, we have problems, but our system of government allows us to fix them. And I'm hopeful that we will.
Andrew Heaton, are you proud to be an American?
Yes.
But
it's not a but. This is a, I feel so uncomfortable right now. Jen, I loved that. That was a wonderful, wonderful monologue. I truly enjoyed that. I think by my just native disposition, I'm not very proud to be anything. Like, I don't, my pride is
what
muted.
What are you the most proud to be?
Okay. So I was thinking about this. I suspect.
Ascot collector?
Huh? Well, like, I don't tend to put pride in groups. I think, I don't know whether it's like.
Do you put pride in prejudice?
Joking aside, it might be that I'm ankle deep in the pool of autism. I think that could be it. There might just be some sort of difficulty in me being able to connect to that. I think,
you in fisherman's pants.
Yeah.
Just waiting out there. In the pool of autism.
Maybe. I think about that a lot. I really ought to get tested. But I think the other thing is, like, I was, when I was in my teens and 20s, I was so proud to be a Republican and an Eastern Orthodox Christian. And I had all these senses of identity that were group based that I lost my faith in. I like left the Republican Party. I haven't been a Republican since 2006. I'm now a low wattage, friendly agnostic, but that is not a major source of my identity. So I'm kind of, there's a part of me that's hesitancy, that has a hesitancy to put a sense of ego or satisfaction in the group that I'm a part of.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, I agree with everything Jen said. I think America is a wonderful country. The only other thing I'll add that gives me kind of pause is not that I disagree with anything Jen said. It just, I feel like personally, I have more, I feel more relation to the individual places that I've been than I do to the country as a whole. And that might make me unpatriotic or bad, possibly, but that's just kind of how I feel. I feel more of a connection to Oklahoma and Edinburgh than I do to South Dakota. I don't know. That's where I'm at. Yay, America. But I'm less enthusiastic and limp-wristed and neurotic than Jen is.
You're not proud.
I'm proud, just not uber proud.
You don't,
but I'm not uber proud of anything.
You want to know what? You don't have a sparkly America jacket. You know what? You do have a sparkling gay jacket.
I do have a rainbow jacket.
So
I sing
you are more signified to a group for which you are not a part than one in which you were born into.
You know what? Hey, listeners, if you want to get me an America suit, send it to Justin's house and I'll fucking wear it. I just haven't found a good America suit that I enjoy.
We need your measurements.
A suit with an American flag cape would be fucking awesome, and I'll absolutely wear that.
You know, I love that you said that you're connected to the places that you've been, because we've heard it so many times on this show. Obviously, Oklahoma, Texas, New York, yeah. DC, you have connections to all these places. But have you considered that one of the reasons that you so easily get connected is because as an American, you can easily fit in?
Maybe so. Although they're getting into heat and psychology here, I don't think I fit in anywhere. I feel like the popular foreign exchange student everywhere I go, and I've made peace with that. But I don't really think I belong anywhere. I think that I get to live in places and form a niche for myself.
You have not found the island of gonzos, all of a sudden you're like, oh, this makes sense.
I have made peace with the fact that I get to be a popular foreign exchange student on this wonderful planet, but that I don't really belong anywhere. I'm okay with that.
That's so funny. I feel the exact same way. Like, I don't fit in anywhere and I never have, but because of that, I fit in everywhere.
Yeah. I know my role wherever I go, and I'm okay with that. And you might absolutely right. I'm not looking to shit on America. That's not the point of that. This is more
sounds like it coming
Heaton therapy or something than it is anything else. But I'm with you on everything, Jen. And it's interesting because I'm about to leave to go to Scotland to hang out there for a bit.
What part of Georgia is that?
It can kind of be exhausting as an American abroad because I suddenly become ambassador for the entire United States every time I leave, and everybody I meet wants to share their thoughts on America and also like put me on the spot and will like do weird, like I was given a speech in Oxford and I was having drinks with these students and one of them went, you know, this pub is from 1532, older than your country, and then just glared at me.
Yeah.
Like I had been like, America's greater than Britain. And he was like, oh, fuck you. And I was like, didn't say anything like that.
I love it when Europeans pull shit like that. And I'm like, yeah, we're fucking young and firm.
Yeah.
Supple.
Well, maybe that's your mistake, is going to English speaking countries. If you go somewhere you don't speak the language, it's like, you know, table, gracias.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, like I've found that I got like minor rock star status when I'm in Asia in a way that does not happen in Europe. Like Europe, you don't get any play as an American in Europe. But like when I go to Asia, like they're like kind of cool. When I went to China, like that was like minor celebrity status by virtue of being American.
I think that's kind of the coolest thing about being American if you go abroad, is that we're famous. You're famous when you walk off the plane, regardless, like whether or not they like your show is a different story, but they know your accent.
There's notoriety.
Well, yeah.
If not popularity.
No, yeah. We're all 1% Iron Man to them. like that we talk the same way Tom Cruise talk. We talk the same way that the American export of culture is so pervasive that we get a fringe benefit of that when you go there. Now, whether or not that is something, you know, great for the pub conversation that you're in the middle of, whether or not it was comfortable when I, you know, went to a Muslim majority neighborhood in London and the guy at the place that I was just trying to buy Strongbows wanted to get into a very deep and very specific conversation about American foreign policy post 9/11, that may not have been the best time to be an American, but I'll take the trade-off. I'll take the fact that when I went, you know, on a trip in college, the ADL sponsored a trip to Poland, Bulgaria, and Israel. And one of the coolest experiences that we ever had was going to a Romani village in Bulgaria. And we're just a bunch of 19, 20-year-old jack-off newspaper editors at various different colleges in America. We pull up on a bus and you would have thought we were the fucking Beatles for everybody that was swarming. Children that had never seen Americans. Americans meant something to them. And with that, and I'll never forget this, getting back to fuck Harvard, the guy who's, you know, I might be able to identify him if you actually do the math, but he was the editor of the Harvard Crimson at the time. And they're very excited. This Romani village is incredibly excited. And they were hailing their representative in the Bulgarian government for being the one to bring the Americans to their village. And so we ate dinner there and then we had this big party and they took over this restaurant and it was amazing and everybody's having a good time and they're dancing and everything. And the Harvard Crimson dude is like, oh, you know, they live in such poverty and I just want to let them know that we feel for them and everything. And I was like, can you shut the fuck up and let everybody party? Like you're gonna shit in their punch bowl by bringing this element of American self-flagellation to what is otherwise them just being happy because Iron Man hadn't even come out. So I don't know. We're all Tom Cruise and Risky Business. They think we're all going to slide out from the back in our underwear and dance to still, you know, whatever that song was. Like that to me has always informed, like, I enjoy American politics. I enjoy American culture. I believe that I am extraordinarily privileged to have been, through whatever cosmic accident, born in this country at the King's Landing of our modern world. You know, the average lifespan in the world is 30 years old.
Here's a fun fact. If your household makes $70,000 or more per year, congratulations, you are in the top 1% of the globe.
Yeah.
99% of the people on planet Earth make less money than you if you're an American that earns $70,000.
In a household.
In a household. So like if you and your husband both make $35,000.
So quite literally, we are the 1%.
We are the 1%. And the vast majority of people in the United States qualify for that. We're doing very well. I'm with you 100%. I'm very, very glad to be born here. And I'll add that while I am neurotic.
And let me finish.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The one thing. I like being kind of a mascot. I like the fact that there is a preconceived notion of what it is to be an American. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but at least I kind of know. And people have an opinion. Like that's kind of cool. Like it's cool that you can walk anywhere in the world. And yes, in France, they're like fucking Americans. And now I can know that I'm fighting from underneath. I can go to Asia and everyone's like, ah, this is great. And I'm like, hey, look at, I'm here. It's a party. That's cool.
I feel like I am America's hostage negotiator where I go abroad. All I'm doing is damage control. I want you to be our mascot, Justin. I think you're a far better mascot of like rocking in with a barbecue. And you like pew, pew. Like you make the handgun motions and put a cowboy hat on and like start playing. Yeah. Like, I actually think you're very, very good.
All the times that I've been in the UK and they bring up guns and they're like, oh, don't you think that blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I just think they're neat. And we can just end it there.
I think you spend too much time in the UK. The UK is like that more than other places. I was in a hostel in Amsterdam during 4th of July, like 10 years ago. And it was full of people from the UK and they kept calling us the colonies. And I basically just like threw hot dogs at them. I was like, just choke on it. But everyone fucking else was cool. L. They were like, happy 4th of July. And I was like, yeah, that's when we defeated these fucks, you know, like it was.
Yeah. Well, can I, even though I'm tepid and neurotic, one thing that I don't like is I really don't like Americans being anti-American in America or abroad. There is a class of people. I think we've all probably encountered them at said hostels. Who go to Amsterdam and rather than being excited to be an American like Jen or Justin, they spend all of their time saying like, God, America's so horrible. I wish I was Belgian like you. And I read that as a very deep civic insecurity that is built around, I want everybody to think I'm more sophisticated than where I'm from.
Yes.
And I am better than other people. You can criticize America, by the way. There's all sorts of shit I would criticize
That's
about
great.
It.
But I love doing
it's,
that.
It's the shitting on it and saying I am better than my country. And I desperately want the acceptance of it's always specifically Europeans. It's always Europeans. I want them to accept me and I'm willing to shit on America to get that acceptance. I find that incredibly distasteful.
Yeah.
I do too, but at the same time, I think especially if it's your first time overseas and like learning about Europeans and we've been told that we're the best country in the world and we have all the things and you find out about their healthcare systems, like I think it's fair to be kind of jealous.
Especially was there a 20-something Jen that was that girl in the hostel?
No, like I said, I threw a 4th of July party for people from fucking Britain. So like, no, I was never that.
All right.
But
you were never that girl.
No, but I also get the jealousy. I understand the people that go over there, especially when they're young and they go, oh my God, we don't have all the best things. Like our government isn't doing what these other governments are. And I feel like sometimes that can look like anti-Americanism when it's really just opening your eyes to that there's other ways to do things and being jealous of what other people have. Cause I've seen it, but I get it.
Could be. Cause again, like I'm going to get shit on France in a minute. I think France's energy sector is a lot better than America. Maybe their healthcare. I don't know a lot about it. Right. There are certainly things I want to steal from other countries that are doing better than we are. And so if we're going like issue by issue and stuff like that, I don't disagree, but I think we're probably talking about different people, Jen, and perhaps we should make allowances for 22-year-olds as opposed to 40-year-olds. But I don't know. There is this particular class of person that I know that just deep down feels they're better than everybody they grew up with and that they should have been in France because they're very sophisticated. And that irks me because it's built around being better than. And I wish more people would travel too. Like I really do, because I think that in the same way that a lot of gung-ho Americans would do well to go abroad and see that we do have some deficits we ought to fix, that other countries are beating us. I think that the anti-American crowd thinks America is the worst country that ever existed would do very well to go abroad and see how much nicer it is to live in America compared to many other countries. And it kind of goes both ways, right? Like when I hear people talk about like how awful America is to women, for example, there's a lot of work to do. I don't disagree with that, but I've been to some countries where I'm like, shit, I would much rather be a woman in America than a woman here. And I can think of lots of different examples like that, right? So travel's good for
I'll
everybody.
Say smoking. Yeah. Smoking's one of the biggest things that when you travel around the world, you realize like we pretty much killed that shit in like 30 years. Mm-hmm. Like we went from Mad Men to no smoking outdoors in California in like 30 years. You go to Tokyo or some other places that we consider to be, if not first world, then beyond
Vienna.
Our.
They might have changed it. When I went to Vienna 10 years ago, everybody was chain smoking in the airport. Every cafe, people are chain smoking.
Yeah, no, there's not even like smoking sections. Like, yeah. it is constant over there. And that's, look, that's fine. That's different cultures. And I do enjoy connecting with them. But the thing that I find unique about America, to go back to Jen's point, is that we have a lot of cultures. We blend a lot of cultures. And I think that there is something inherently really, really cool that we do have an underlying core OS, you know, and I would think about it in that, you know, programming terminology. It doesn't mean like the same OS that powers your calculator is the same one that powers Adobe Audition, that powers all this telecommunications. Doesn't mean that they're the same thing. They're often different and many of them are conflicting or competing with each other. But at the very least, there is one uniting thing, and that is we like to complain about our country. And that's really cool.
You know,
is that we can do it better than anybody else.
I like
else
thinking
on the planet.
Of it as an operating system.
And I don't give a shit about what happens in any of your countries.
One of the things I love to do when I get railed in Britain, because like people, they'll get a couple of drinks and go, you know, I rather like you. I don't typically like Americans, but you're okay. And then what I always go is, do you not like African Americans? And they go, oh, no, I'm fine with them. Yeah. And I'm like, what about Asian Americans? They're like, oh, no, they're fine too. Yes. I was like, okay, what about like Native American? No, they're okay. And I'm like, okay, who do you not like? Well, you know, loud, fat people that are white, that have cowboy hats and guns. And I'm like, yeah, you hate Texas. Congratulations. You hate Texas. America is where the entire world went. It is a window into the world. It's the most multicultural, pro-immigrant society in the history of mankind. If you hate America, you hate Earth. The operating system bit, I think there is something to that. And there are elements that I am genuinely proud of and enjoy about the American experience and ethos that I find a weird mirror in another country. So, for example, when I go to the United Kingdom, which I love, it is a permission-based society. It is a society that has been fucking ground under the heel of feudal lords for 2,000 years. And as a result, if you want to like grow roses in your garden, your first impulse is to go to the town hall and ask permission. May I grow roses? Are we permitted to grow roses? Like, that's not how America thinks. America's like, I'll fucking put a pool in my front lawn and you come fight me about it if you have a problem with it.
And then we'll bitch about the HOA.
Yeah, and I like that.
These fuckers at the HOA said that my diving board was too high.
Yeah. I very much like that anti-HOA spirit at America.
All right, there we go. Some American propaganda for you here on Independence Day week. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. A call to adventure, a road of trials, death and rebirth, only for Joseph to Campbell to tell you. We're not wrong pod at gmail.
Like the Joseph Campbell reference. Thank you. Yeah. Hero's journey.
Too many Kennedys writes, the amount of times that Jury and Jen said JFK or JFK Jr. in place of RFK and RFK Jr. was really throwing me. Take the time to say the right names.
So, first of all, you know that we didn't do that on purpose. And the fact that he's RFK Jr. and you stick that fucking J in there and we have to say it over and over again, like, you know it was an accident. So I just, I look at this email and I'm like, imagine having the time in your day to write that email, to get that upset about us making abbreviation. But like, oh, they said the wrong abbreviation with letters that intermix. Like, I'm going to go out of my way to email them about them. Like, you're so blessed. I'm happy for you that you have that much time. It must be nice.
Yeah. So you're not saying that you wish the fate of that emailer the same as JFK and RFK.
Fucked up, Justin.
That's gold. Jerry writes, the governor of Illinois can teach Georgia a few lessons on how to manipulate the electoral process. Not only did the state pass a typical gerrymandered map, but he also argued his used his political fortune to handpick his opponent in the gubernatorial election. He created a PAC that supported a MAGA candidate to defeat the moderate Republican in the primary. This made for an easy win in the blue state's general election.
Yep. I think that we increasingly as a people view things as red team versus blue team. And I wish we would get a little bit more healthy people and regular humans versus politicians. I think politicians as a class tend to have kind of similar sentiments in terms of keeping power and rigging the game.
Maybe a show that focused on politicians without the red versus blue stuff.
Like the skillet artistry of it.
Maybe that'd be an interesting thing that would be have cultural worth. Money for Bush picks writes, in 2004, I gave money to the Bush and Kerry campaigns. I got three glossy photos of Laura and George. I voted for Kerry, but I put one of those Bush photos on my dad's TV room where he watched Fox News every evening. I call that bipartisanship.
I call that hedging your bets. Did you get an ambassadorship?
It's the exact opposite of what I did.
Yes. You hid your parents, right?
Yeah.
Coast Guard member writes, there are search and rescue operations happening daily within America's navigable waters. Sometimes the victims are rich. Sometimes they're poor. Although survivability is much better than ever before, thanks to modern technology and safety requirements, rarely a search and rescue ops covered as much as the sub was. I personally feel like it's because dying in a submarine is scarier than dying in the open air. Heaton, do you believe that dying in a submarine is personally for you scarier than dying in the open air?
I'm just going to take his word for it. I feel like he has more experience with these situations than me. Sure. Yes.
I just think it's less common. I think we like these stories where you just go like, what the fuck? Like a boat tipping over. It's like, okay, that can happen. But a bunch of billionaires in a sub, the Titanic, like there was just so many things that made you go like, what the hell is this story? Yes. We like the weird stuff.
News value. There's a science to this. It's called novelty. It's part of the judgments of news value. Has it happened often? The reason why you say the phrase a man bites dog instead of dog bites man is because it is illustrative of a thing that does not happen so much. And so that's why that got covered. As far as boat singing, this used to be a running joke on Now the Great Night podcast that for whatever reason, when we were first, this is when Patreon was new, right? And we were at a point where our Patreon number was going up so fast that we could put a year to it, right? And so we would be like, oh, it's 1235, and we go to the Wikipedia of 1235. The running joke was every year a famous boat sank. Every year, no matter what, as long as we've been making boats, they've been sinking and they were big news. So now it happens so often, we care about submarine sinking. 5-star review says, I purchased Heaton's book. It's funny, full of libertarian bullshit, but still funny. Thank you. Thank you for buying my book.
If you want kind of a primer on basic economics, there's a whole section in there. It's called Laughter is Better Than Communism. You can find that on Amazon. And to that listener specifically, I want to give you major kudos. It is an increasing rarity in our country to be able to disagree with something and find it funny at the same time. A lot of people only laugh at shit they agree with. So you probably have a great sense of humor and a nimble mind. And I wish that you were the rule rather than the exception.
Release the Snyder Cut writes, so the Wagner Group is the Suicide Squad?
I didn't see that film, but yeah, maybe.
I also don't get the joke.
That's the one with the Joker, right?
And I'm here for the gal with the mallet. Shut up, Jock. I'm here for you, nerds. Just know that I'm here. I'm here with you. When you hear my voice, know that it is speaking on behalf of our community. Review of Bentonville, Arkansas writes, it's a very bike and dog friendly city. There's a farmer's market in the town each Saturday. The art museum is free. The music's great. And there's a ton of craft breweries around. The only con is coastal money moving in and buying houses with cash. So who knows when I'll get a home. That and the Waltons get your firstborn. So by and large, it sounds like a pretty
Ozarks
nice
are fucking beautiful. I love camping there.
We should go.
A Tale of Tax Anxiety writes, in 2016, I started my a business on the side of my main job. That took my taxes from the basic 1040 to complicated and gave me a huge amount of anxiety that I can't explain. So I didn't do them that year. In 17, that anxiety doubled because it was twice the amount of taxes and the fees. So I didn't do them. You see where this is going. I went 4 years without doing my taxes. I finally paid somebody to do all 4 years in 2020 when I couldn't get a mortgage without returns and W-2s. And you want to know what the IRS did to punish me for not doing my taxes? Nothing. I even got my return for all 4 years. Turns out they know if you owe them money, and if you owe them money, they will come after you hard. If they owe you, they don't give a shit. And they will just let you not get money, as far as I can tell, indefinitely. Getting 4 years of returns in one go did help make buying that house a teensy bit easier, though. I have actually heard this from multiple people that have not filed taxes knowing that they were going to get a return. And it has never been an issue. There is no penalty. They'll be like, yes, you can give us an interest-free loan, that's fine.
Yeah. My dad is an accountant. He's done my taxes forever. And back when I was poor, which was not that long ago, he would just be like, he would file them late and be like, you're fine. They owe you money. It doesn't matter. Like, they're not looking at you at all. And so I would file my taxes late all the time. And like, they didn't care. They didn't care until I started making money.
One of my all-time favorite tweets from a guy named Jordan at Stratton. Kudos, Jordan. Government, you owe us money. It's called taxes. Me, how much do I owe? Government, you have to figure that out. Me, I just pay what I want? Government, oh no, we know exactly how much you owe, but you have to guess that number too. Me, what if I get it wrong? Government, you go to prison. I think it's really funny.
Well, you have to pay private companies to tell you how much you owe. Like, that's the racket. That's why we can't get that changed. Because
yeah, you're right.
Plenty of
TurboTax,
people.
Whatnot.
Yeah, yeah, TurboTax. And then is it Hewitt Packard is the other one that no one uses? There's two companies that are lobbying to get Congress to
Jackson
never,
Hewitt.
Ever.
Jackson Hewitt, I believe. Not Hewlett Packard is the computer.
I got a term there's that if you've not Hewitt heard it, I think you'll love, Jen. Have you ever heard of a confusopoly?
No.
This was coined by Scott Adams, and the idea of a confusopoly is that a small group of companies fill the rhetoric with such complicated bullshit that you can't make just decisions in terms of who to go through.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds about right.
The human spirit triumphs brings us to a close. I want to thank Jen. While I almost always disagree with her on policy, she reminded me this week that not all people that share her views are moral monsters. I was furious after seeing in particular Ely Mistel's tweet about the submarine and Alito. For those of you who did not see this extraordinarily popular tweet by an extraordinarily famous person, it essentially made the joke that if Alito wants to go on another big billionaire's retreat, as has been controversy with some of the Supreme Court justices, that he should go on the sub. Ha ha ha. He would die underwater. We go back to the email. I found myself starting to fall down the, quote, leftists are morally bankrupt, unquote, hole. But Jen's compassion in the episode reminded me that most people are fundamentally good. They're empathetic people who may just happen to disagree with me on particular policy matters. And I would like to editorially thank Elon Musk, the owner of Twitter, who now will probably rate limit this person's access to his service so he might not see these kinds of baiting tweets that spin him into a moral tizzy. Jen, you're a guiding light for our listeners. How do you respond?
I'm having an anxiety spiral because early in this episode, I pretty much said that I wish Dick Cheney didn't get a heart.
Way back.
Yeah, listener, you were right the first time.
You were right.
Jen's a moral monster.
I'm a monster, and I apologize.
Nah, it's fine. I joked about both Kennedys getting shot. We're Not Wrong Pod is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Jen, it's your week off, so do you want to plug something or just wish a happy 4th of July to everybody?
You know, I actually do want to plug something because on my week off, I listened to Brianna Joy Gray's Bad Faith podcast, where she had someone who is an expert in vaccines, Dr. Vinay Prasad. And she kind of went point by point with him talking about RFK Jr.'s vaccine opinions. And so she's actually personally interviewed him. They listened to the JRE episode and we had just talked about that. And I found it so level-headed and informative. He agrees with RFK Jr. on some things, not on some others. It was just so good. And I feel like this audience in particular, as a follow-up to that episode of We're Not Wrong, I think you guys would really enjoy that.
Look at that. Look at that. Plug in another podcast. Eden, do you also want to altruistically plug your friend's podcast or do you want to be a selfish piece of shit?
I will altruistically plug one of my friend's podcasts. Let me think about it. For this very good reason, I am covering affirmative action SCOTUS trial on the political orphanage this week, which has significant overlap with the first hour of this program. So let's see. Go check out Great Night because
I was
on it and played a drunk judge. I wasn't really drunk. That was just excellent acting skills on my part.
Yeah.
But go check out Great Night for just some good, solid comedy that we did Friday night.
How was the live show? I wish I could have been there. How was it?
It was great. It was a lot of fun.
No, we love that venue. I wanted to have that venue for We're Not Wrong, but now they love us. Mm-hmm. So the sooner you get back, the sooner we can do another Austin live show in that venue.
Excellent.
We might actually make money as opposed to paying Alamo Draft House, $200.
That would be nice.
Yeah, no, that was really, really fun. And just for the record, I think your balls are full to bursting with sperm.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that.
Ew.
It was a...
Go listen to that podcast want the setup to that joke.
I mentioned sperm at least three times.
Yeah.
My sperm tits, count. Andrew's balls. Which body part are we going to talk about of Justin's, just to make it fair?
Prostate.
You want to know what? I will plug my own podcast and talk about the phallic American-specific obsession with the subject of guns. I had a long-form conversation with my friend and CNN contributor, Stephen Gutowski, who also has covered the issue of guns on his website, The Reload, for many years. We talk about the current state of our political back and forth, the Supreme Court case that will, by the way, be resolved in the middle of a presidential campaign next year. So this time next year, the Supreme Court is going to make a ruling on guns that will probably drop a hand grenade in the swimming pool of what will already be a contentious time, and specifically go interrogate the talking point of guns are the greatest cause of death for children in America, which was not true, is now true, but for issues that you might not think. Hmm. That will be my tease for that. But that wraps it up for us here on this program. Till next time, for Andrew Heaton, Jen Briney, and me, Justin Robert Young, we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.